Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What really happened the night the Titanic went down? And why has it taken a century for experts to fully understand the minute-by-minute effects of that fateful iceberg strike on the world's first unsinkable ship, or at least what was billed as such? Today is the 100th anniversary of the Titanic's maiden voyage, which famously ended in tragedy in the North Atlantic after 5 days at sea. While we are nearly as saddened today by the more than 1,500 lives lost as those for whom the story was breaking news, we are able to get a far clearer picture of exactly what went wrong thanks to remarkable advances in underwater robotics and remote imaging. Journalist Hampton Sides explains what scientists have learned in his cover story for the April issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called Titanic: What Really Happened. Hampton, welcome back to Think.
Great to be with you.
So there are Titanic-obsessed people living all over the world, as we know, but a lot of the most interesting recent research has been headquartered at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. Can you tell us a little bit about the place?
Yes. The Titanic has all these different homes all over the place, but Woods Hole has been there from the very beginning. When Bob Ballard discovered the wreck back in 1985, the expedition was led by Woods Hole, and I think they've kind of taken something of a proprietary attitude about the wreck ever since, and have been training increasingly sophisticated cameras on the wreck ever since. This gentleman, Bill Lang, that I interviewed there, was with Ballard for the very first expedition that discovered the wreck, and he's still developing better and better imaging technology to capture the wreck. And that's just something that's so extraordinary about the Titanic, is that it's been a driver for all of these advances in technology. The most recent images that were brought back from a 2010 expedition give us a view of the wreck that's never been seen before. It's a 3D high-resolution optical and sonar map of the entire wreck site that was taken by these submersibles that flew at low altitudes over the wreck in these tight patterns. They call it mowing the lawn. Many, many thousands, maybe millions of images were snapped by these submersibles and then digitally stitched together into this mosaic. And that's what's published in the magazine, and that's really the focus of the article, is sort of, what is this map, what does it tell us about the wreck, and what is it about this wreck that has led to it being such a driver of technology like this.
When you say stitched together, for people who haven't yet picked up a copy of the magazine, it is absolutely seamlessly stitched. You cannot tell where one image ends and the next begins.
Yeah, I was at Woods Hole when they were doing some of this work, and what happens is they bring all this data together into this imaging room and work on computers, and they have a lot of geo-referencing material attached to every image, so they know exactly where the submersible was at any given moment when it was snapping a shot. But underwater, you know, it's a pretty dynamic environment, and there's pretty strong currents. So sometimes the submersible will shift a little bit to left or right or up and or down. And so what they have to do is do this thing called geo-rectifying, which means they kind of correct little errors that way and take the right image so that you don't get these sort of distortions caused by shifting currents down there. It's a very labor-intensive process, but it uses technology that didn't really exist 10 years ago. And the thing is, you know, all these different expeditions down to the wreck site, starting in 1985, were very limited in their view. You go down there, you're looking through a portal of a submersible or submarine. You're only able to see what the light allows you to see. You're kind of trapped, as one of the experts I interviewed said. It's sort of like looking at New York at midnight in a rainstorm with a flashlight.
Good luck.
And now it's not a flashlight. Now someone has flipped the lights on down there, and you can see everything. Over a 200-acre debris field, we're talking about, you know, every crane, every davit, every boiler, every piece of engine, every scrap and shard of the wreck. And you can now begin to see these patterns, and this leads to the sort of the real geeks and wonks who are kind of the forensic guys who really can't get enough of the wreck itself, how it happened, how it broke up at the surface, and what it might tell us about, you know, perhaps some flaws in the design of the ship and things like that.
So broke up at the surface, that's an interesting point, because for a very long time, the so-called experts on this said unequivocally the ship went down in one piece, despite the fact that there were eyewitness accounts to the contrary.
Yeah, well, there were both. There were some witnesses who said it broke up at the surface and others who said it didn't. Of course, the Cunard Company, the liner company, and the folks who built the ship in Belfast were all... we should say what? Invested in the idea that it didn't break up, that it was a strong ship and it withstood those pressures. But it wasn't really until Ballard's expedition in 1985 that it became clear that it did break up, because the ship was found in two spots, essentially the bow section, which was more or less intact, and then about 1,800 feet away was the... 1,800 yards away was the stern section, and it was mangled, many different pieces lying about it, but then it became absolutely obvious that the thing did break up. But I still think that, you know, with the Cameron movie and with a lot of the written accounts, you still have this idea that, you know, all right, it broke up at the surface, but then it, you know, it was a calm night, dead calm, it probably just sort of slipped beneath the waves, you know, gently beneath the waves to its death. And what this doing this article became made very apparent to me was just how incredibly violent that descent was. It's 2.5 miles down. There's all sorts of powerful hydraulic forces being subjected to the wreck, and you know, things are ripping off, and you know, the stern section becomes almost unrecognizable by the time it hits the floor. So it's much more violent death throes than I had ever imagined.
And for months afterward, pieces of debris from the wreckage were actually washing up ashore in Newfoundland.
Right. Well, a lot of things floated and a lot of things were thrown overboard. And, of course, there were like things like deck chairs and any kind of wood that would float. Certainly some bodies or parts of bodies were found. There were rescue ships that went out to try to locate bodies and came back with, I think it was around 300 corpses that were mostly buried in Halifax in a mass grave that I went to. So yes, I mean, there was a lot of stuff on the surface that was found and became, you know, part of the wreckage.
Hampton, it sounds awful to even say this, but I think 17 years after that discovery, people might take for granted what an amazing achievement it was for Bob Ballard and his team to have found the wreck. It's 2.5 miles down. Talk about why, even though we knew the essential coordinates of where Titanic was, it was such a big deal to actually locate the wreckage.
Well, you know, we had coordinates, but of course the ship drifted that night for a while before it finally did break up and sink. Mm-hmm. So we were never absolutely sure of the coordinates. The other thing, you know, it was like 2 hours and 40 minutes between when the iceberg struck it and when it sank. So it had 2 hours and 40 minutes to kind of drift. Of course, then once it broke up at the surface and descended, it also drifted, if you will. It didn't just go straight down. It went at an angle and went, in fact, in two different trajectories, the bow and the stern. So what they were looking for was spread out over this. It's actually, the core of it is 200 acres, but the actual full site is over 1,000 acres of the seabed. So, you know, it just took a very long time with all the side scan sonar equipment through the 1960s, 70s, up into the 80s, before someone hit pay dirt. And really, I mean, Ballard was lucky. He almost didn't find it. And, you know, it might have been a number of years beyond that before they would have actually located it. So it was quite a feat. And, you know, the thing about Ballard is, though, it's sort of like Oppenheimer with the atom bomb. He found it, and then he began to regret finding it because he felt like it unleashed these forces of commercialism that, you know, in terms of salvage operations and tourist dives down there that have damaged the ship. And so Ballard has become this real purist. You might say it's slightly hypocritical because, you know, he found it, but he thinks that, well, you know, this site really ought to be declared an international underwater heritage site, that it's essentially a graveyard and should be left alone, and no one should go down there except for perhaps people who want to take images. But you know, RMST, which is the company that has the salvage rights, has brought back more than 6,000 artifacts from the wreck over the past few decades. And, you know, they're very, very much criticized by scholars and archaeologists for having done so. But no one is more critical than Ballard.
RMST, though, is an interesting sort of subplot to this because it appears, based on your coverage, that they have taken a sort of about face in recent years, and they are behaving differently about the objects they're able to recover than they did years ago.
Well, yeah, they've had new management, and they have come to see that you know, they've got to stop fighting with the experts and start collaborating with them if they're ever going to hold on to this thing. And you know, they've come to view their role as custodians of the wreck. This expedition from 2010 that resulted in the sonar map that I was describing earlier was led and paid for by RMST. Here they were not pulling up artifacts, but paying for this incredibly expensive imaging. So they've definitely taken a different tack. They actually want to sell the artifacts. I think they kind of want to get out of this business, but they are legally restricted from, you know, selling stuff off piecemeal on eBay or whatever. It's got to be completely intact. It has to go to someone like, you know, a major museum, someone who can curate these materials and properly store them and all that.
It's so, pretty.
But yes, they have had a bit of an about face, and it's been an interesting thing to watch. The scholars from NOAA, from U.S. Park Service, from Woods Hole, people like Cameron have all started cooperating with and collaborating with RMST. So it's been very interesting.
It's pretty astonishing that anything is remotely intact. Things like leather goods and metal. What has to be done to preserve objects that are brought up to the surface from underneath? And actually, I've just asked you this question and left you about 10 seconds to answer before we go to break. So hang on to that in your head, and we will talk about that in just
All right.
a moment. My guest is journalist Hampton Sides. He wrote the cover story for the April issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called Titanic: What Really Happened. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send a question or a comment via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Hampton Sides is my guest this hour. He wrote the cover story for this month's issue of National Geographic magazine called Titanic, What Really Happened. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Hampton, there is this question of how you preserve remains that have been under the sea for a century. What happens to them when they come out and get dried off?
Well, in this case, RMST, the company that has the salvage rights, which is based in Atlanta of all places, has these storage warehouses where they keep all this stuff, and it's a very labor intensive and very complicated setup. You know, in terms of certain objects need to be exposed to more moisture, so some rooms have they're constantly pumping in moisture. Other rooms have to be extremely dry for certain kinds of materials. They've got things like, you know, jewelry, clothing, leather goods, pieces of the ship that are metal. And, of course, just once they bring this stuff up, they have to do all kinds of things to leach out the salts and things like that so that these objects don't just completely crumble. So there's a lot that goes into it. And someone said, yeah, you know, you can go down there and get this stuff, but it's sort of like getting a St. Bernard puppy, you know. It's really cute at first, but then you realize what a complicated endeavor, expensive endeavor it is to keep this thing going as an enterprise. And that's what they've done for the last 20 years.
So let's talk about the breakup of the ship itself. You write in the article that James Cameron, the explorer and film director, likes to use a fresh banana to sort of illustrate how that all happened.
Yes, I went to Cameron's place in Malibu, and he had assembled a bunch of these experts, these authorities. Some of them are pretty wonky. You know, it's definitely a branch of Titanic research that is out there on the fringes. Only a certain number of people can even talk about this stuff because it requires that you know essentially every inch of the ship and understand the engineering and the architecture and, you know, all kinds of things like hydraulic forces and so forth and so on. So you kind of have to be an engineer even just to enter the dialogue. But Cameron is pretty good at, coming up with analogies, and he always likes to bring out this banana and kind of shows the way it pooches out when he wrenches it in his hands, and then finally breaks apart. But the banana peel, the last little part to break is the bottom of the banana peel, which is supposed to illustrate the keel of the ship. I suppose you could say, and when you listen to these experts talk this way, that it's fascinating, but it's also, you know, a little perhaps cruel or gruesome, because, you know, what you're really talking about is human lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they really get going and really get to arguing, I kept kind of asking myself, well, you know, what about the people on board? What was going on in their last moments as all of this incredible wrenching of metal was going on? It's easy to lose sight of that.
I was so glad you brought that up, and you bring it up in the piece as well, because when I watched the documentary that was made that contains a lot of that sort of arguing, I had the same thought, like conceivably there could still have been people inside when the ship actually went down.
Right. Well, I think most of the people who died on the Titanic, and there were about 1,500, most of them died of hypothermia at the surface, bobbing in their life preservers. But almost certainly there were dozens, scores, perhaps hundreds of people still inside the ship, most of them in third class, hoping to get to America. And, you know, we don't know what they experienced, but we can only imagine. And it's just terrifying to even contemplate.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go to the phones now and speak first with Len in Irving. Hi, Len.
Hi. I'm just curious. I don't want to sound macabre or anything, but I'm just kind of curious, the people who did go down with the ship, what may have happened to them, and if there were any remains found, and what's being done to preserve their dignity. and I'll just take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Well, almost certainly people did go down with the ship. No remains have been found that I'm aware of, mainly because of something that happens chemically to bones under pressure. It essentially, over time, the bones dissolve, essentially. That's my understanding of it. However, there definitely have been things found down there that indicate the presence of a corpse. In some cases, shoes found in a certain pattern that it was clear they were coming off of a human body. What's interesting is leather does really well and survives the conditions down there almost better than anything.
Hmm.
And it has to do with the tanning process and the chemicals involved, which retard the microorganisms that tend to eat shipwrecks. So anything that you've seen in the RMST exhibits that have traveled the world, just about anything that's in good condition was found inside a leather bag or a leather suitcase. So, you know, perfume bottles, champagne bottles, clothing of various sorts, watches, things like that, that have, you know, been found intact have tended to be in leather. So that's generally what we found is a lot of leather stuff.
There are parts of the interior of the ship that also appear seem to be very, very well preserved, and it's those special tiny robotic aquatic units that have discovered those. Is that right?
Right. Cameron obviously made the movie and made a ton of money with it, and what's often overlooked is that he is also an explorer and has paid for and led a huge number of dives down there. I think he's been down there 33 times.
So he's not a dilettante just wanting to sort of catch up on what he was doing. This is really an obsession for him.
It's an obsession of his, and you can see it when he talks. I mean, you know, there's sort of a Melvillian intensity about him. He gets really wound up on the subject, and he's dead serious about this stuff. And he keeps saying, oh, I'm finishing up this. You know, I'm never going to return to Titanic, but then he always keeps circling back. But one of the things that he developed with his brother and some other engineers is these very nimble, agile little robots that can go into the wreck and take these images and bring them back. One of the problems prior to that was that the robots tended to be big and cumbersome, and they would get hung up on things down there, and, you know, they were very expensive. So, you know, whoops, there goes $3 million, that kind of thing. Now they're much more agile and much less expensive. And able they're autonomous. They don't have to have the fiber optic cable and the power cable attached to them. They're able to move a lot more nimbly in the water. So that's why those images that you're talking about in the issue that's how they were obtained, was through these robots that Cameron has developed.
It occurred to me, and he said in the documentary, this has nothing to do with my film Avatar, but we've created these things and they are avatars. And yet I did sort of make the link between how the creative process for a film with a plot like Avatar, where you have this strange and foreign world that human bodies can't survive on, and the work that he was doing to allow himself to be a witness from a distance to this inaccessible place to human beings. There had to have been some cross-fertilization there.
I think so. There's definitely a disembodied quality to piloting a robot that is taking images. You begin to think like, you know, maybe you're in the robot when in fact you are maybe 1,000 yards away. And if the robot is in danger, you feel like you're in danger when you're not actually physically in danger. The robot could round a corner and you think you're rounding that corner in the same peril that the robot is. So, you know, he talked about that a good bit, and I think it probably informed his other blockbuster movie.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phones to Derek in Arlington. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Ms. Boyd. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I think I'm picking up on the same theme as your previous caller about the people. In Mr. Cameron's movie, I was wondering if your guests would comment. In Mr. Cameron's movie, the people seemed, well, you know, we had brandishing of weapons, some shots fired, people, there were punches thrown and whatnot. Overall, when you look at virtually every actual account account of eyewitnesses, people who were there, what you hear over and over is the incredible dignity. A school teacher in one of the accounts referred to serenity, even the honor of being among that group as they died. What are your thoughts on the differences between the accounts that we read of and maybe some of the theatricalization that we see in the film?
Well, you know, I think it's one of the reasons why the Titanic story is so enduring. People can't get enough of it. There's something in there for everyone. But one of the things is just how it provided a snapshot for that time period. And for the most part, like you say, for the most part, people were honorable and they kept to their stations. Everyone did their job for the most part. There are exceptions. Of course, the plot that you're referring to in the movie with the gunshots and, you know, the jealous lover and all that, I mean, that's Hollywood, and, you know, I think that's just, you know, that's just part of the inevitable scripting that's gonna happen. But
Excuse me for interrupting. We should remind people that Jack and Rose were entirely fictional.
Jack and Rose were entirely fictional. There was no, what was the name of that diamond, you know, that's entirely fictional, but you know, but in terms of the authenticity of the sets and the period authenticity of the costumes and some of the actual characters, the secondary characters of the movie, Cameron actually got it right and spent an enormous amount of time trying to get it right. And I think the biggest role that Cameron's movie played in terms of Titanic research is, you know, just rekindling this interest among a whole new generation, which has enabled some of these expeditions. Quite frankly, I mean, there is a direct result in terms of, you know, mounting an expedition that's very expensive. Cameron's movie has shown, you know, that people are fascinated endlessly with this wreck, and it's certainly led, I think, directly to expeditions like the 2010 one.
Can you talk, Hampton, about what it's like to be, and obviously you became very engaged in the story to write this piece, but what is it like to be in a room full of people who really have thought about little else for years or decades of their lives?
Right. The rivet counters,
yeah,
they call themselves, and the geeks and the freaks. I think it's fascinating. I mean, you know, I certainly started this project with certain skepticism. I didn't really understand what it was about this wreck that made it so mesmerizing, and I was a little skeptical, like, what can you really say now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything's been said. How many books, how many pamphlets, how many documentaries? But it's like one of those subjects like the Civil War and Pearl Harbor and, you know, a handful of others that, you know, just it has all these experts and it has all these little sort of little subcultures within the larger culture. And it's fascinating to be around. There's one guy in the story, Bill Sauter, who is probably the world's greatest expert on the Britannic class of ocean liners, which includes the Titanic, Britannic, and I can't remember the other
one. Was it Olympic?
Say that again?
Olympic?
I think of the Olympic, that's right. And they were built at the same time in Belfast, and they're almost identical. He knows every inch of those ships. And so when he is studying the wreckage of the Titanic, he's able to, it's sort of like a Where's Waldo project for him. He's able to, you know, pick out these little things. Look at that pipe there. That is clearly from the first class dining room, because there's this mechanism here where, you know, he knows, he's working backwards essentially from his own knowledge and able to identify every little part down there. So it's pretty fascinating just to sit there in Atlanta on his computer and watch him piece through the wreckage this way.
Are they all guys, these rivet counters?
It is. I've been saying guys, and I meant literally guys, I guess, because it does seem to be a very male-centric world. I don't know why that is. Maybe it goes back to boys building models and seems like the kids who are really into this subject who buy the coloring books and the models, they're all boys. I don't know why it is, but it seems to be the case.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Rhodes on the line in Willow Park. Hey, Rhodes.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was thinking about your comments about just the considering the engineering and the mechanics of the ship coming apart and how that's a little bit strange in light of the human toll. I read the article, and I have to say, before, I really never had an interest in the Titanic. It had never been something that I really understood why it's such a big deal.
Sure.
And in reading the article, I guess I probably would fall into the class of people that the rivet counters would be. I was just completely captivated, and I think it brought it to life for me in a way that that all of a sudden I started thinking about what it must have been like for these people to be on the ship as it went down in the water, and it was sort of interesting to me that I was suddenly in understanding, and I would say the article does just an amazing job of helping, I think, to understand how this thing happened. It really humanized it for me, and I wonder if that is the case for some of the engineers that have been working on this project.
I don't know. I haven't really talked to too many people who are engineers since the piece came out, but National Geographic really does a great job with these kinds of pieces. The article is one thing, and I appreciate your comments about the article, but the gatefold thing that comes out that shows all this stuff, all the time and effort that went into the graphics, and not to mention all the images and the map, it's greater than the sum of its parts. It's just a really great package, and I think this is one of those subjects that National Geographic has always felt it's sort of their turf.
Baez is journalist Hampton Sides. He wrote the cover story for the April issue of National Geographic. It's called Titanic, What Really Happened. We'll go back to this conversation in about 2 minutes. Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Hampton Sides, who wrote the cover story for the April issue of National Geographic. It's called Titanic, What Really Happened. Join this conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Hampton, another thing you really help us understand with this piece that is beautifully illustrated by the pullout section. Did you call that a gate? Is that what you call the pullout?
I think they call that a gatefold.
Gatefold.
It's like a printing term.
It's what everybody loves about National Geographic. But anyway, the timeline of this, because you have 2 hours during which the ship is sort of going down, certainly in alarming ways, but slowly. And then all of a sudden in the last, a little more time passes and it's getting worse and worse. And then in the last 2 minutes, the ship goes from partially above the surface to the floor of the ocean.
It's incredibly violent. And, I suppose you could say it's a little gruesome for us to be, micro-analyzing that plummet, that descent. But we can't help ourselves. It is fascinating because ships, are supposed to float. They're not supposed to do that. Mm-hmm. And when they do that in such a violent way, it is endlessly fascinating just exactly how it happens and where it happens and how it ends up.
How is it that the ship did not capsize?
I don't know. I don't know. That would probably be beyond my engineering knowledge. But the thing is, everybody knows, of course, that it struck an iceberg. And what people increasingly told me was, if it had hit the iceberg head on, it probably would have survived the impact.
Hmm.
What happened was that it hit the iceberg in a very particular way, that glancing sort of side-swiping action as it was trying to outmaneuver the iceberg, gashed or nicked not one, not two, but five of these watertight compartments. Those were the things that supposedly made the ship unsinkable, because no one could envision a situation where five or more of the watertight compartments would ever flood. But because they did, it was a certainty. The engineer and designer of the ship was actually on that maiden voyage. He went down there, ascertained the damage, and knew immediately that the ship was going to sink. Hmm. You know, it was a mathematical certainty. So it was just a very particular kind of situation that no one could have envisioned. I think, again, another one of the reasons why the Titanic is so endlessly fascinating is that, you know, it shouldn't have happened. But for this, that, and the other, like any sort of Greek tragedy, it would have been a very different outcome.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ian on the phone now in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hello again. Before I start, I'd like to mention that I was very impressed by the way you lot handled that little bit of nasty weather last week.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
It was very informative. Question. Oh, yes. I've read more than once that the ship's orchestra band stood on the deck when the ship was going down, playing Go Nearer My God to You or some such. Is there any truth in this?
It's true that the band played on. That's where the expression came from, and it's true. Again, this is sort of speaks to people staying in their stations and doing their jobs until the bitter end, like the Marconi radio operators who stayed in there and kept sending out distress signals till it was almost until the ship was about to sink. What precisely the band was playing at the very end is the subject of endless debate. And this is another wing of the Titanic subculture, is the sort of the historians and the people who are really interested in the life of the ship, what they ate, the costumes, and questions like this. What exactly was the band playing at the bitter end? So, but yes, the band was there, and everyone says that calmed the passengers to a great extent, that they could have been complete hysteria, but for things like that made it seem a little more tranquil and peaceful in those last moments.
It makes sense in a way. You know, maybe they assumed if the band could still be playing, maybe there was hope for them.
Yeah. You know, another thing, though, people talk about the lifeboats and how more people could have been saved, but in the first full hour after the striking of the iceberg, no one was getting in those lifeboats. People thought, well, that's dangerous. Why would I get into a little teeny vulnerable boat when I've got this unsinkable ship?
Mm-hmm.
There was a denial. There was, people were incredulous that this ship would actually sink, even though people, knowledgeable people, were telling them, you know, it's going to sink, get into those boats. So that's one of the problems they had for that first hour or so, is just convincing people.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the phones, we have Sarah calling from Plano. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
One of the things that's always bothered me about the movie Titanic is that Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet were running around the ship knee-deep, sometimes waist-deep in water, which you would assume in that part of the world was cold, but it never seemed to affect them until they were actually plunged into it. Can you speak to that?
Well, you're right. The water was freezing cold. I've forgotten the exact temperature, but I believe it was right at the freezing point. There's icebergs all over the place, and it's the kind of water that would induce hypothermia in a matter of, you know, a minute. I think it would have been very difficult for them to do the kinds of things that they were depicted doing. But I got to say that the Cameron movie, it was not my cup of tea. I really wasn't a big fan of it. Maybe that's kind of what turned me off the Titanic, and it took this story for me to kind of get back into this world and understand what the real attraction is.
It's funny. I felt the same way. The special effects were extraordinary, but the rest of it, the plot, I could have thrown out the window.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a beautiful love story, and I guess that was Cameron can be credited with discovering these two young actors, I mean, who've gone on to do amazing things, but it just really wasn't my cup of tea.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Larry in Fort Worth. Hello, Larry.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'm an engineer, and I'm going to try really hard not to be pedantic, okay?
All right.
But I did want to comment. There was kind of a comment earlier that says, wow, this was, you know, a really specific set of circumstances that caused the Titanic to sink. And I agree, it was specifically the way it hit the iceberg that caused it. But then there was the further comment that, and we really didn't have predicted it. It's very interesting because actually we could have, and we did, but it just wasn't listened to. The Titanic sister ship had been involved in a lawsuit previous to this where its draft had caused it to unmoor a small boat, which then ran into the side of the Titanic. And in the course of that trial to decide whose fault it was that this happened, the hydrodynamics of a ship that size were discussed in detail. And it was proven that this was exactly the kind of thing that happened. But the problem is people didn't understand it, and they didn't understand the techniques that were used to describe this kind of thing, and so it was missed. And I just think that's really an astounding fact.
Well, it's a really interesting point that you bring up, Larry. I appreciate your call. She did break up a little bit in the connection, Hampton. I don't know if you were able to hear enough of that or if you were familiar with that aspect of the story.
Yeah, I think it was the Olympic, and there were a lot of questions about the designs of these ships, and because they were on a scale that really had never been attempted before, and there were among the engineers there was in England and in Ireland there was a lot of talk about what sorts of stresses can these hulls withstand, and there were some bugs that definitely needed to get worked out in the Titanic. They did very little trials with the Titanic. This was its maiden voyage, and although it seemed to hold up just fine until it hit the iceberg. But I just think it's a classic story of hubris. This idea of a ship being declared unsinkable and people ignoring those very things that she's talking about, those cautionary notes. We were such believers in technology then. Everything was on this endless upward spiral, telegraphs and telephones and wireless devices and elevators and, we were great believers in the future. And I think people ignored the warning signs.
It's hard not to let that sound familiar, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's the human condition, I guess.
Yeah.
And, it sort of ebbs and flows. There's optimism about this, about what we can do and what we can design and innovate, but we always come up against the limits of those innovations.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Dick on the line in Wiley. Hi, Dick.
Hi, and I missed a little bit of that previous conversation, but could you go on and talk about, if you hadn't already talked about it, the whatever happened to those other ships of the same class? Were they ever retrofitted, or were they dry docked, or what happened to them?
I'm almost positive they both ended up on the bottom of the ocean. One was sunk in World War II. It was converted into a hospital ship and was sunk near the coast of Greece. And it's a wreck that is quite often visited because it's not very deep. The other ship, I can't remember what happened to it. I believe parts of it were sort of cannibalized, and it was kind of used in various ways during the war, World War II being World War I and World War II. But I'm not entirely sure. It's a good question.
I bet if people really want to know, it's probably a quick Google search away to find
Titanic and Olympic.
Mm-hmm. So would you, if given the opportunity, would you go down into one of those submersibles for yourself?
No, I have discovered in the last 10 years or so that I'm extremely susceptible to claustrophobia,
mm-hmm.
and I think I would completely freak out. To be, you're basically in a bathtub for 7, 8, 9 hours, and I'd probably have to take so much Valium that I would be useless down there as a crewman. So I think I'd be better up on the surface.
Yeah, it really does. You know, it fills you with respect once again for the people who do this work, because it's one thing to think about it; it's another thing to really be down there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the technology involved in designing a submarine that can withstand the pressures of 12,000 feet. These are mostly Russian subs, actually. The Russian Mir subs are the main vehicle that's been down there. Cameron is trying to develop, is developing his own submarine to take him down to the Mariana Trench. But, you know, yeah, just if you have any susceptibility to vulnerability to claustrophobia, you don't want to be in one of those things.
What can we assume about the continued deterioration of what remains on the ocean floor?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about what some might consider an academic discussion of, like, should we pull things off or not? Should we take back artifacts or not? Is that, you know, nature is doing more damage to the Titanic than any salvage operation,
right.
And it's only a matter of time before nature is going to win, and there will no longer be a Titanic. It might be 100 years from now. It might be 500, but you know, it is being consumed by microorganisms. It's turning into a big pile of rust, and for some reason, I find that comforting. I find it wonderful that nature kind of always wins these battles, but it does make you wonder. Well, if the clock is ticking like that, if we're gonna learn anything more about the wreck, if we're gonna bring back anything more, we got to do it in a hurry. And Not so much in a hurry that we don't do it professionally, but you know, the time is ticking.
And it sounds like there are people who are willing to invest the resources and the energy to get it done in the near future.
That's the thing about the wreck. I mean, it's sort of like the Everest of shipwrecks. Mm. It is so many advances in technology of mountain climbing and dealing with altitude came from people wanting to climb Everest. It's sort of like the moon, you know. It's like the moon was the goal of NASA and the Apollo program, but it was all those spin-off technologies that I find the most interesting, and that's sort of what the Titanic has been, is this driver of interest and technology, and, you know, people just can't get enough of it.
Journalist Hampton Sides wrote the cover story for the April 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called Titanic, What Really Happened. Hampton, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Been my pleasure to be back with you guys.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.